Welcome to part two of our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I'm here with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, and we're here to answer your questions. By the way, tell us again, Layla, how listeners can get their questions to us.
Please email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. Again, that's radioprogram@AOL.com.
All right.
We love your questions for the podcasts. We also love your questions for the newsletter as well.
And a little housekeeping detail is that this weekend will be the last weekend of our preemption of our Saturday program. By the way, you can always listen live via drhoffman.com. We've got a listen live button there. And you can, when our program is aired to the national audience, when we record it Saturdays from noon to 2 p.m., you can listen to the entire two-hour program by going to drhoffman.com and listening via your computer. If you're stuck in the dark ages and you're merely listening through that ancient device, the radio, not sure what that is anymore, but then this weekend for one more week, you'll be listening via WOR if you're in New York City. That's Sunday night from 11 p.m. to midnight. WR just carries 1 hour of our program, but it is actually a two-hour program. And, of course, podcasts will be available on Monday morning if you miss both the live program and its rebroadcast Sunday night. And on April 12th, we will return to our usual spot Saturday afternoons from 1 to 2 p.m. on WOR.
Hooray.
That's a complicated explanation.
Yeah, it's been a while, but it'll be good to have you back on Saturday during the day.
You know what's really weird? A lot of people really like that Sunday night time because they're kind of chilling and relaxing after their weekend. And an amazing number of people listen to the radio when they go to bed.
That's true. It helps some people to fall asleep. Not that they would fall asleep to you, but, you know, they're nicely decompressing.
They fall asleep to me. I exert a virtually hypnotic influence on people. And some people got really used to it because for many years I was on late nights. Mm-hmm. On WOR. Every weeknight I was on from 11 to 12 p.m. and then I think from 12 to 1 p.m. at one point. Mm-hmm. And so people really got used to hearing my voice in the middle of the night and they missed it. They said, oh my goodness, I won't be able to sleep. They sent hate mail to the radio station. How could you do this? You're destroying my life. I have insomnia now. And so for at least Sunday, one more Sunday night, we will be back on the air to soothe you with the dulcet tones of my voice, which immediately will put you into deep REM sleep. So, okay, well, let's see. Let's pick up our questions once more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is about waist-to-hip ratio, and this is from Diane. Diane says, first, Dr. Hoffman, I have downloaded every podcast you ever made.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
My condolences to you, Diane.
In August, you discussed with Layla the multiple issues with waist-to-hip ratios and BMI. I am an outlier, I guess, but I'll let you tell me. My BMI, my body mass index, is 19.8, but my waist-to-hip ratio is 0.96. My body fat is measured in two health clubs and by one MD at a medical fair, ranges from 38 to 40, exclamation point.
Percentage.
Mm-hmm. The MD said it is hereditary. My mother and her mother had large abdominals. Okay. My A1C is 5.6 to 5.8.
Okay.
And then she talks about her cholesterols, which are not that important. They're pretty much in line. I exercise every day, biking, hiking, strength training, skiing. Am I in big trouble? The big tell, Diane, for me is your A1C, possibly your hemoglobin A1C, and the fact that you come from a long line of belly women. I understand where you're coming from. But that is the bigger tell. And I think with that in mind, having the more android shape, which is more belly fat, rather than a gynoid shape, which is hip and thigh
women. Sometimes referred to as apples and pears.
Apples and pears. So because of the apple shape, we have to be a little more vigilant with all of that in terms of our A1C, number one, but in terms of our diet. It just may be that any whole grains you're eating, even that healthy bowl of Scottish oatmeal or steel-cut oatmeal in the morning, may not be doing you any favors at this point. So that would be the first place I would look. Trim the carbs, even the good healthy whole grain carbs, and try to go lower. Especially as we get older, especially us apple-shaped women, it becomes a little harder to do. So we have to be more vigilant.
You consider yourself an apple-shaped woman?
Yeah.
You're not an apple-shaped woman. Maybe you were once. I didn't know you when you were on a different type of diet. You've always been relatively slim.
I come from a long line of, we are. But there is a lot of diabetes and coronary artery disease in all the women, and strokes, and wow.
Okay. Well, so several observations on this. This presents a very interesting case because, you know, we're looking at these markers, mm-hmm. and all of these are markers that are more or less predictive of risk. BMI, waist-to-hip ratio, hemoglobin A1C, and the value of these things is that they tell you on aggregate, on average, are you at risk? But sometimes this can be misleading because there are outliers.
That's true.
There are, for example, people with a very high BMI who can be very healthy.
Yes.
They are the so-called, not even just athletes. There are some people who are, they look chubby. They look pretty chunky. They look chunky, but they might look at, for example, Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm. Winston Churchill was a guy who looked really fat already when he was a young man. He never looked slim. He always had a big paunch. And then when, even in World War II, you see these pictures of me, he had a big rotund belly. Mm-hmm. He lived well into his 80s. He might have lived longer if he hadn't pickled himself in booze and smoked cigars and done all kinds of crazy stuff. So they're outliers to that. The other thing is that there is this phenomenon which we have labeled TOFI, thin outside, fat inside, which are people who have cardiovascular risk, even though they seem to be thin. She has a 19.6 BMI,
which is fine. But the fat percentage is
telling. It's visceral fat, and that may be what is giving her the abdominal bulge that she has. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to know. We can't tell definitively from these tests that she is doomed. The hemoglobin A1C is somewhat indicative, but sometimes people with hemoglobin A1C of 5.6 is borderline, I would say. Was it 5.6 or 5.7?
It's 5.6 to 5.8.
Okay, so 5.8 is crossing the threshold to pre-diabetes. 5.6 would be on the right side of that. We'd like to see optimally 5.2, 5.3.
Yeah.
I think Dr. Perlmutter, when he talks about grain brain and an ultra-low carbohydrate diet, he strives for under 5 or in the 4s. Which I seldom see, unless people are on the most stringent carbohydrate restriction.
The thing is, I think being apple-shaped or android may warrant something like that. That's possible. But the other caveat here is it just may be that Diane simply doesn't have hips.
That's a good one.
She could be just very straight.
Yes, that's good. Yes.
She could be skinny straight.
Right, right. And that would throw that test off.
Right.
And therefore, she actually might be more subject to the male rules. And the male rules are that if you're under 1, you're okay.
Mm.
But women, because they have hips, we suggest that they be under 0.8 or 0.75.
Yes.
And that is a simple, let's remind people what that is. You divide your waist circumference at the narrowest part of your waist by your hips at the widest part of your hips.
Right.
And so for men, because they don't really have hips like women, we want them under 1.0. So were she a male, she would not be at risk by these criteria. Maybe she has a more, less, I mean, shall we say, android.
Maybe she's
Android, of course, comes from the word male-like configuration, and gynoid is the female configuration. So it just may be genetic with her. The ultimate test is, wait for it, the GTT.
Oh, the GTT, absolutely.
The glucose tolerance test.
Where am I? Yes,
yeah, because,
absolutely.
Because that's the real tell on whether you have metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance. I mean, I just had a patient where we spent, 20 minutes. Do I have insulin resistance? Do I have insulin resistance? Can you tell? Can I tell? I said, look, you didn't do a glucose tolerance test when you first came in.
Yeah.
And I'm not able to tell you that. If you want, we can do that test. And that's a test that requires sitting in the doctor's office for 4 or 5 hours. Take sugar, you see what the blood sugar is, but more importantly, you see if you overproduce insulin, which is really a driver of cardiovascular risk.
Absolutely. Okay. Okay.
This one is, Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, what is your opinion about using nitric oxide to lower blood pressure? 3 grams of high-quality fish oil, kaolic garlic, hawthorn extract, grapeseed extract, and magnesium are presently being used along with a food rich in potassium. I exercise regularly along with walking for an hour at least three times a week, and I am not overweight. Yeah, it's all good. The one controversy here is about these nitric oxide products. It's not that clear to me that they all raise your nitric oxide. They usually contain arginine or sometimes citrulline, mm-hmm. which are amino acids that seem to lead to greater nitric oxide production. And it's interesting, you know, one of the side effects of taking a nitrate medication, which really pumps up your nitric oxide, is that your blood pressure drops precipitously sometimes and you pass out, you faint.
Oof.
So you have to be careful. Can supplements do that? Generally, it requires pretty high amounts of arginine, even given intravenously, to lower blood pressure. So I'm not sure about that, but I agree with the high-quality fish oil, the chiolic garlic. Hawthorn is an herb that also seems to strengthen and regularize the heart rate and may help to lower blood pressure in some cases. Grapeseed extract protects the arterial wall and relaxes the endothelium, allowing the arteries to expand, and blood pressure then thereby goes down. And magnesium acts similarly. And then food rich in potassium is a good idea as well. So I think this, I approve this program, Terry.
And good aerobic exercise.
Right.
Absolutely. Okay. Do we have time for another?
Indeed we do.
Oh, great. Okay. This comes from Susan. Any tips for losing weight post-menopause? I eat a healthy diet, salmon 3 to 4 times a week, no white flour, sugars, and exercise, but cannot lose 10 pounds. Never had a weight issue in my entire life until now.
Well, welcome to my world. I mean, isn't what we deal with day in and day out?
Yeah. Susan, may I say, if you've been eating healthfully all of your life, that's a wonderful thing. But if you've been eating the same way, and now you're post-menopause, and you have a pesky 10 pounds, mm-hmm. you may have to go farther.
Yeah. So the analogy is if you have a car with a certain size engine and you add 20% of the car's weight to the car, you know, maybe you put a roof rack on with some, you know, suitcases, the car is going to go slower. Similarly, when you go through menopause, you actually stop doing something which takes up a lot of energy, which is menstruating, you know, and making eggs. That mm-hmm. actually these organs are energy-consuming organs, and essentially they become dormant after menopause. They don't completely stop working, but
right.
the uterus shrinks, the ovaries stop doing all their production of eggs, the variety of slowdowns occur in a pretty critical organ system in the body, and there's less energy requirement. So that's mm-hmm. part of why there's a slowdown. So if you're maintaining the same diet and the same exercise level, and most people actually slow down as they get older, there's going to be a net weight gain. Occasionally what we see, though, in some menopausal women is there's a shrinkage. Why is there a shrinkage? You know, they said, yeah, I lost weight since menopause. I said, well, typically where you lose it is from your breasts and your buttocks, where you have subcutaneous fat that is affected by estrogen, and mm-hmm. you may actually become frail or stick-like, you know, lose those curves. But mostly it's weight gain. And, you know, we notice this even in our pets. You know, when we spay and neuter animals, they become a little chubbier and less, you know, they just, they get a little rotund.
I think it's the feed, too, unfortunately.
Well, of course, it's too much
yeah.
table scraps and the wrong kind of food. But
there could be the issue of thyroid postmenopausally. So that would be a question.
When I see this kind of situation, I think of something called Syndrome W, mm-hmm. which is a concept that was developed. And there's a book on that subject by a colleague of mine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She's a professor of endocrinology named Harriet Mogul. M-O-G-U-L. She's written a book called it's four parts. It's menopause, insulin resistance, stress, and hypothyroidism. And mm-hmm. it's a it's a syndrome that afflicts many women around midlife and causes them to gain weight. But this is also when insulin resistance develops more, just because it develops more as you age. And it's also a time when very often your thyroid wears down. Plus, you have the absence of your hormones. And also, this is often the sandwich generation. You have more responsibilities taking care of your parents. Your kids are not out of the box completely. There's financial woes. There's concerns over aging itself. And
Cause a rise in cortisol.
Rise in cortisol, absolutely.
That's a stress on your adrenals. As we know, a rise in cortisol will put us in fat storage mode.
They call it Syndrome W. That's the title of the book. And Syndrome W, actually, one of the components is Syndrome X, which is the insulin resistance. So Syndrome W standing for women, the thyroid, the stress, the insulin resistance, and the menopause, they come together in a perfect storm, and you gain weight. So what do you need to do? You change your diet. Sometimes we replace hormones. We fix the thyroid. We give thyroid hormones, thyroid support. And we also address stress. We try to bring cortisol down.
Address stress. You may need to incorporate more strength training as you go further, a little less cardio. Never give up the cardio. That's not what I mean to say. But we have to give equal time to strength training because we want to be concerned about sarcopenia, loss of muscle mass as we get older. This is the time in life to make sure that you're getting good quality proteins and fats in your diet and not leaning away from a higher protein or a higher fat diet. Most people, as they get older, they tend to go vegetarian or, again, this person is just postmenopausal, not elderly, but a lot of elderly people are just having their tea and their toast, their crumpet, their piece of fruit, and not much else. There's not enough protein there to support all this. You also need your protein, don't forget, to support your thyroid. So this is also important.
And it turns out that most people who have low thyroid function, they do better on a higher protein, low carb diet. I just find that almost uniformly. Vegetarian diet for hypothyroidism,
no,
not so good.
Because you're not getting your sources of zinc, of selenium, of tryptophan, which is an essential amino acid. So these are critical for thyroid function. And if you're vegetarian and you're concentrating too much on soy,
damages
for your
the thyroid.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cruciferous vegetables may damage. So what, I mean, this the reason that we chuckled when we heard this question is that this is a typical problem that presents itself. Mm-hmm. You know, and frankly, there is a little bit of inevitability to this because, you know, people want to, I think in this day and age, they don't accept aging in any way, shape, or form. They just don't understand, well, why at 60 can't I look the way I looked at 30? I mean, why? I mean, I want to. What is the technology that will enable me to look identical to 30?
And this, you mean besides plastic surgery?
Right. But no, that's what we're supposed to do, sort of that inner metabolic fix that restores them to total youth and vibrance. And that's really our goal. Mm-hmm. But think about it. This is actually probably the baby boomer generation is maybe the very first generation that
refuses to age
en masse. I mean, maybe in previous centuries there were a few individuals who aspired to that, but that was really an eccentric viewpoint. Most people were resigned to that. You know, you see the pictures of our grandparents. You know, my grandfather, I see pictures of my grandfather and when I was a little kid, my grandfather was maybe he was in his 50s. He looked like such an old man. Mm. I'm older than he, and you know, they wore these sort of clunky, boxy suits, and he wouldn't have been caught dead in a track suit, working out at the gym. That just was not happening in that generation.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Although, God bless him, he managed to live to be 101.
Wow. Wow, God
and,
bless.
And it wasn't because he was following a very specific lifestyle. He didn't go to some anti-aging spa to get injections of youth hormone, things like that.
Well, hopefully his epigenetics are carrying over to you, Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, I think there may be, hopefully I will inherit some of that. So, all right, so that's, do we have any additional questions or is that?
I believe that is it.
Okay. Very good. So let me just comment on one final thing, which gets my ire. This is an editorial from the New England Journal of Medicine, mainstream medicine's most important voice. And there is an article in here, and I gasped when I saw this because I knew it was coming. Hazards of Hindsight, Monitoring the Safety of Nutritional Supplements. And in this article, they conclude that if consumers and physicians are to have confidence that all supplements are safe, the law regulating supplements must be reformed.
Uh-oh.
Every supplement ingredient should undergo rigorous safety testing before marketing. Until that happens, consumers and physicians cannot be assured that the pills, powders, and potions... Sounds disparaging, right?
Is that Paul Offit?
No.
Oh.
That the pills, powders, and potions labeled as dietary supplements are safe for human consumption. This comes to us from the Cambridge Health Alliance and Harvard Medical School in Boston. And they cite as examples of dangerous things, calcium, which can cause kidney stones, ephedra, which has already been banned, that's been taken off the market, ginkgo, which can cause bleeding, although I've never seen that. Cancer, which can be caused by beta carotene and vitamin E.
Oh, boy.
And
more misquotations of studies.
Right.
Of bad studies.
And also, they talk about these really dangerous herbs. Aguiline, chaparral, comfrey, germander, kava, and usnic acid. Have you ever used
usnic
those things?
Acid.
I don't even know what some of those things are, but they're citing these things as if their use is rampant and using it as justification for these onerous new laws that they want to push. I mean, really, this just keeps coming up again and again and again, and they want to really crack down on the supplement industry. And this is the voice of the medical establishment, and I'm really concerned. I really think that this is heralding another effort to highly regulate the supplement industry, because if every supplement ingredient undergoes rigorous safety testing before marketing, what that means is a very complex bureaucratic process that is going to involve the government, of course,
yes.
And it's going to involve submissions to the government and lengthy delays. And what's going to happen is that the only companies that are going to be able to meet these stringent requirements are the pharmaceutical companies. They'll be selling us, quote, safe supplements, mm-hmm. because they have a vast bureaucratic machinery that can enable them. They're already used to getting drugs approved. They'll be the ones who can schmooze their way to drug approval and, in effect, pay to play for mm-hmm. drug approval, because it costs to apply for drug approval. This is going to herald a sea change in our supplement industry. So, look, it sounds really reasonable. We want to protect the public from harm. I recently wrote an article on that very subject, 12 supplements that you should never take. That's in the newsletter this week.
Yes.
But the answer, my friends, and this is my opinion, in my humble opinion, government regulation is not the answer to the problem of poor quality supplements. And, we need industry organizations like the Council for Responsible Nutrition. We need...
Well, you won't ever see them quoted in the New England Journal of Medicine, because if you turn the page, there is a pharmaceutical ad, I'm sure, or at the back of this.
Let's see what we have here.
Or something.
Let's see what we have, because I'm just curious as to where the pharmaceutical ads are. Here's one for a new antiarrhythmic drug, Eliquis, which has been criticized because it can cause irreversible bleeding. If I read you the side effects.
And they're pointing out ginkgo?
And they're pointing out ginkgo as a problem. This one is, let's see. I mean, basically the drug sponsorship is permeating these magazines. And, that's the name of the game. This one is for a medication I've never even heard of. It's called, this is actually an interesting medication. This is actually Croton Lechleri. This is something called crofelemer, or Fulixac. That's hard to pronounce.
Wow.
This is actually a medication that's derived from botanical medicine. So this is an example of a medicine that was used traditionally by Amazon Indians for diarrhea. They did some experiments. They found it was helpful in AIDS diarrhea. And now it's FDA approved, so they would want to ban it in the health food store, but it's okay if a drug company... the drug company Salix Pharmaceuticals makes this stuff. Now, that's okay. See, that's okay. But, they went the conventional route, And now I guess they want to make sure that nobody can buy it over the counter. And on it goes. So that's just a little appendix to today's discussion. And if you want more information on this, a reliable source of information about the struggle to maintain our access to supplements of our choice, anh-usa.org. Please sign up, join that organization. I'm on the board. It's a good organization. And they'll fight for you as a consumer to make sure that you continue to be able to purchase the supplements that are supporting your health and well-being. I think it's a wrap for this week's edition of Intelligent Medicine.
I think so. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, and a very happy April Fool's Day. And none of the information that we just shared with you is true. This is our. Please disregard this entire podcast because this is our April Fool's edition of Intelligent Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us.